he specifically like looked in the camera and was like, Donald Trump, don't kill this bill. Work with me on it.
I agree that that particular line was, I think, a little bit off. And like what he should have said was like, Lindsey Graham, don't act like a pussy. And
yes.
Like, come
there you go.
Work with me on the immigration bill.
Hey, everyone. You're listening to a free preview of the Politics Podcast. In this episode, Matt and I are going to talk about Trump's now infamous bloodbath warning. There's been a backlash to the bloodbath warning and now a backlash to the backlash to the bloodbath warning. Matt and I come at the controversy from different angles, which will hopefully illuminate it in an interesting way. And then we're going to grapple with the question of how liberals and Democrats should grapple with an opposition that plays these kind of language games because they don't really think that the truth of the matter is relevant. We hope you enjoy the conversation. And if you like what you're hearing and want to listen to the whole episode, go to politics.fm and upgrade your subscription. Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Politics Podcast. I'm Brian Beutler.
I'm Matthew Iglesias.
This past weekend, Donald Trump went to Ohio, and depending whom you ask, he warned that either the auto industry or the whole country, or maybe both, will be in for a quote-unquote bloodbath if he loses the election. So the quote is, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole... That's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the whole country. So short version, he said this. Liberals pounced, and I think they pounced largely because they've come to realize that if they don't make a big stink about outrageous things Trump says in his stump speeches, then desensitized newspaper reporters will just kind of ignore them or not cover them. But he got the whole GOP, Trump, after this controversy hit for a day, he got the whole GOP, including platform owners like Elon Musk, to lash out at the media because he wants to insist that he was only talking about the auto industry being in for a bloodbath if he doesn't get to come in and save the day with a huge tariff. So Matt, give me the counterintuitive take that this was good news for Donald Trump.
Well, I don't even want to go there. I think that this is an interesting moment in terms of the themes that you and I like to talk about for a few different reasons. And one that I think is really important, right, is just that, like, as you conceded, liberals did pounce on this. Mm-hmm. Right. And the pouncing was efficacious, right? Like in the sense, like it got day one articles written in the mainstream media that like said that Trump had warned of a bloodbath if he won. Right. And so like, it works, like unified pouncing when you either are sincere or at least convincingly perform sincere, right? Like people didn't think that like, liberals were just being like third order arch about this. They weren't going like, can you imagine what the reaction would have been if, you know, they were just like, Trump said this thing, I find it outrageous. Then that successfully generated coverage. And
people should go look at like Brian Schatz tweeted about this. Mm-hmm. And he's like one of the, he's more clear eyed about this stuff. He's the senator from Hawaii. And he was like, don't overthink it. He said there'll be a bloodbath if he's not elected.
So I think that this is important because something that I sometimes hear from you, from our mutual friend, David Roberts, from certain people on, you know, I think the joke used to be like do something Twitter. I sometimes hear the sentiment that like liberals like never do this. Or like can't do it. That like conservatives just like have the media, you know, dancing on their puppet strings, but liberals are always on defense. And this is just one of, I think, many examples that come and go over the years where like that's not true. Like when liberals really do get fired up and like go to town over something, they can make it happen. They've got the juice. Mm-hmm. This got pushback, though, because, you know, the context, you read the full quote about the bloodbath. The immediately preceding section of the speech was about low-cost Chinese electric vehicles. And Trump was calling for, I think he said, 100% tariff on imported Chinese cars. And he went from that into the bloodbath digression. So, you know, one interpretation of his remarks is that he was warning of a bloodbath in the automobile industry. And that's then been the pushback, right? Which has come, you know, unanimously from conservatives, from Elon Musk, et cetera. But they've also sold a lot of fact-checky types. Like I think I saw, you know, a Mother Jones reporter saying, you know, Trump was talking about electric vehicles. Kevin Drum said, you know, Trump was talking about electric vehicles. I think particularly among the subset of liberals who pay a lot of attention to climate policy issues and have been like, there is this ongoing question. Like the Biden administration is weighing tariffs on imported Chinese electric cars. This is like an ongoing policy controversy. And so, you know, they really elevated the idea that Trump was just kind of weighing in on this policy debate. To me, what I find a little, I sometimes think about, this is like a joke, but like we could have like a TV show that's like where people are like media fact check attorneys, you know, and like Judge Chris Saliza is there and has to make a ruling on how many how many Pinocchios you get.
You're mixing people up, man.
It's not Saliza. Who hands out the Pinocchios?
Oh God, it's also
Glenn Kessler. Right. This is a case where I, as a discourse attorney, would feel comfortable taking either side as my client. You know what I mean? Like I could, sure. I could argue the case either way. I think it's interesting that, like, my question is like, why do we want to litigate this particular case? Because I feel like last week we had news and pouncing about Trump and Social Security and Medicare. Mm. And we said on the show that like we thought Trump would try to like slink away from this. And he has, you know, he's been trying to slink away from it for the next week. At the same time, like there was a good piece, you know, MSNBC or NBCnews.com about all of Trump's many flip-flops and stuff on this issue. To me, there was also a good infographic came out. Some, you know, econ wonks did a thing about how huge a hole in the deficit would be blown by all of Trump's tax things. We've also got a couple like rich Republicans keep being like, I sure love Donald Trump and I'm a billionaire, right? I would love to see continued pouncing on that point, which like mm-hmm. we know to be a central point of political vulnerability for Trump. And we also know to be something that like the media is inclined to give him a pass on in a weird way. Like reporters think that like public policy is dull. But if you pounce aggressively, like you can force this stuff onto the agenda. I feel like Trump has now, you know, it's not like, well, it's over, but he has successfully this week wriggled away from a set of stories that were really bad for him into this kind of baseline, is Trump a maniac or is the media maniacal in their coverage of Trump? And my like model of Trump era electoral politics, right, is that like his goal is to wrestle every specific thing that comes up back to just like that question of like Trump the maniac versus Trump derangement syndrome. You know, and like every win against Trump is when you can have the story be like literally anything other than that. And that anytime Trump brings it back to like the media is being hysterical about Trump, it's just kind of like, we're just everybody's back to their corners. It's nothing surprising. He's not very popular and like never has been. Like he won in 2016 with a low share of the vote. People don't like him. He has very little ability to like burnish his image. But we went from having a conversation that was like about the impact of Trump winning on the lives of people who like Trump or who are disappointed with Joe Biden to back to this thing of like, is the press unfair to him? Are the libs hysterical, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Especially because like the case for the bloodbath, right, is that like we know Trump believes in political violence, right? Like from January 6th. So it's like, what was added from the bloodbath? Like what, Like, what did you change your thinking about on the basis of Trump saying bloodbath? Like, or like, what would you hope to change the thinking of my father-in-law about?
Okay, let me like answer there's a lot to chew on. I'll start at the end. One of the big conundrums that the Biden campaign is facing is that their theory of the election is that their base will reconsolidate when they realize Donald Trump really is going to be the Republican candidate again. And they're just going to need to be reminded of how unpleasant and alarming they found him. And so it's not so much that anyone learned anything new. It's that, like, this is a good tool, a good reminder for people who may have kind of forgotten just how much they disliked him, that he's still there. He's running for president again, and he's just as bad as he ever was, if not worse. So you have sort of like two models of like how to make an effective political attack. And they can both be deployed in the same campaign. And the bloodbath pouncing is about base consolidation. It's about, and like maybe Trump sees that as like his least bad thing, where like if he can get something to a 55-45 fight where it's about how disgusting he is, he loses less bad than if it's like his tax policy or his Social Security policy. But they're two different things, because the pouncing on Trump toying with the idea of cutting Social Security isn't so much about galvanizing like emotional sentiment, getting everyone like real fired up to vote against him. It's about sowing division among Republicans. And so you want to do both things, right? You want to home in on things that Trump does that make the 60% of the country that doesn't like him really upset with him. And then you also want to find these wedge issues that make the people who fund his campaign and the people in Congress who have made this devil's bargain with him think he's maybe not such a safe bet, right? And like, I think they're both great. Like I don't think that you can run 8 months of a campaign on a thing Trump said in a phoned-in interview to CNBC about Social Security. You make the most of it while you can, and then the next weekend he says bloodbath, and you go with that, and then you try to, you know, like it's Joe Biden, I think, has become unpopular less because of any single thing that happened than because Republicans have made sure we're ensconced in this kind of farrago of constant negativity about him. Like one day it's because he's too old. The other day it's because he's crooked and like running a crime family. And then, you know, the next day it's because this failed. And you know, it's if you get your media the way I think a lot of people do, which is in like bits and pieces here and there, you're getting a lot of information that tells you Joe Biden is fucking things up. Well, like, who can play at that game? And I think that's essentially the story of the Social Security to bloodbath pivot.
One thing that is different here, right? I mean, like, you can imagine a world in which Democrats tried, you know, like Trump benefits from a 50 plus year campaign that dates back to Spiro Agnew, if not earlier, on the part of the American conservative movement to delegitimize the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. Right. And he works it, but he also operates inside that context. Right. When it's like the single moment when Biden's popularity fell the most was still during his first summer in office, during the fall of Kabul, which I felt was like grossly unfair media coverage of him, that it was, you know, he was getting very negative coverage in the New York Times and in CNN. And it was incredibly harmful to Biden specifically, because people who are open to Joe Biden, like, take CNN and the New York Times incredibly seriously. And I, like, wanted to work the refs. I wished it could have been done more vigorously, more forcefully, more effectively. But also, like, there's nothing you could do from a messaging standpoint that would like alter the structural dynamic that like Democrats take CNN and New York Times reporting seriously and Republicans don't. It's not that that can't be changed, but that's like, that's the work of generations, not the work of like a week-long messaging campaign. And so one asymmetry around this kind of thing is that just seeding the New York Times with anti-Biden stories is very effective anti-Biden politics. You know what I mean? Like if the New York Times runs articles that are like, Joe Biden, he wears old man shoes, like that hurts Biden. The New York Times making random kind of negative observations about Donald Trump, it's not obvious to me that that hurts Trump in the same kind of way, because the people who are open to voting for Trump don't care about that. The unique value of something, like you were saying, Social Security, right? Abortion. Something that can get right-of-center people disagreeing with each other about is that those facts can be aired in media outlets that potential Trump voters care about.
I mean, Trump went to Breitbart to try to clean up his...
Sure, right. But I mean,
it's like comments, which kind of tells you, like, he was worried not so much about whether it would make liberals not like him, because he knows liberals hate him. It's because he worried that like there might be some people who get their news from Breitbart who are wondering, like, is he going to cut my Social Security?
And you can also, but you can also imagine a world in which, like, a conservative radio host is like, we should cut Social Security. Like, Trump was right. You know what I mean? Like, it's hard. It's a harder environment that Democrats are playing on. But that's why I think that, like, these kind of things that end up just getting, like, all conservatives to be like, oh, the media is being unfair to Trump. I hope it, like, consolidates Biden's supporters around Biden. I mean, that would be great. I think it would be lovely. On the other hand, like, my experience is that, like, the number one thing that leftists hate most in the universe, like it just drives them to absolute rage, is if you observe to them that Republicans are the more conservative political party and therefore they should vote for Democrats. They think this is like weird, dirty pool, or you're like guilting them or something like this. And so like, I don't really know what to say about
in terms of consolidating the base
in that regard.
The main thing to say is that I think that the leftists who do that are either not going to vote for Biden anyway, or they will, but they're going to be pissy about it, which is fine. Let them be pissy about it. Take your point, like run it all the way through. Like, something has to go on the front page of the New York Times every day, right?
Yes.
And we know from 2016 that sometimes what goes on the front page of the New York Times is like email, 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 email.
Yes.
Such that by the end of the election, when we're all like, oh shit, like all hell's broken loose because Trump won, you go back and you're like, what pierced the consciousness of the American public? And it was like emails. And I think that was because right-wing media was talking about emails ceaselessly, but also because the New York Times was talking about emails ceaselessly. And we can't do anything to affect how Fox News is going to cover this race, but we can use whatever influence we have over how the New York Times thinks about its role in all this to suggest that there's more important things in the world than Hillary's emails or Hunter's laptop or whatever.
This is like
proof positive that they can be bullied into basically reporting on the election with a better sense of the public interest.
Right. But so this is my other concern about this. So if you look back at 2016, right, 2016 media coverage, content analyses of it, like the coverage was more negative of Trump than it was of Hillary, like in the aggregate. There were more kind of anti-Trump stories on the front page of the New York Times than there were anti-Hillary stories. The difference is that Trump in this, you know, this old Simpsons gag where they're asking like, how can Mr. Burns still be alive? And right. And so it's like, there's too many.
Invincible.
Right. So, I mean, just so people know it's like they showed like too many viruses and bacteria all trying to squeeze through the same frame at the same time. And they're like stuck. And I feel like Trump news, particularly in 2016, was a little bit like that like a very large share of anti-Hillary stories were about her email server, and many of the other anti-Hillary stories were about purloined emails from John Podesta. So like Hillary emails, even if there were three times as many anti-Trump stories, they were split across 20 different topics, right? And this is, I think, actually part of the reason why Trump opponents need to not like not mention other kinds of things about Trump, but really try to decide what are like the top two or three things we want people to hear about Trump. And whatever is happening in the news, make sure that we drag it back to that, right? Like you can say like Trump is promising a bloodbath to cut your Social Security. Yeah, you know, like whatever it is. I should probably workshop okay. that a little bit yeah. harder. But you know what I mean? Like the risk of this kind of thing is that what people hear is constant vague buzz of controversy about Trump on the one hand, and open borders, high inflation, he's too old about Biden, right? Like, duh, 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 right? And you need that like rat-tat-tat focus of like, what is the criticism of Trump? And I thought, because we were agreeing, we were being very agreeable a couple weeks ago. We were talking about like Trump corruption stories, you know, because like those have a really nice tie-in to like Trump policy stories, right? Like the corrupt politician and the like rich guy politician is like a great, you know, nexus. It's a fusion. Biden, you know, they cut out a little video where they like had the bloodbath. They had the Charlottesville, you know, pitchfork guys. Maybe it's base consolidation. Like maybe it works. But I'm skeptical. I'm particularly skeptical because I did think that this one was a little bit of a reach, right? Now, when Trump talks about January 6th hostages and how like I'm going to pardon them.
But it's the same thing. It's the same thing. Like he did it. He did the national anthem sung by the January 6th hostages at the same speech. And like, I think that there is a universe in which Democrats and liberals home in on some sort of political opponent. The political opponent says something that's kind of an edge case. Like if you interpret it ungenerously, you can really like pounce on it. But if you're being a little bit more honest with yourself, you give them a pass. And like, I've actually experienced this personally as a journalist, like, in 2016, or maybe it was still 2015, but during that primary, when Jeb Bush was still an ongoing concern, I think that they were talking about a school shooting, or maybe it was the Pulse nightclub. It was some horrible thing that happened. And he was trying to deliver the Republican line on this, which is like, we're not going to do anything about mass shootings. But he was trying to deliver that message in a empathetic sounding way. And he was at some point in this thing talking about all the, you know, crises that happen when you're running a government. He said, stuff happens. Okay. And so stuff happens turned into a meme in the same way that bloodbath has. And I was at the New Republic at the time and I wrote a piece. I was like, look, you can believe, and you should, that the Republican policy on mass shootings or assault rifles is horrible. But what you're trying to impute to Jeb Bush just didn't really happen, and lay off, right? And like people got pissed at me for it. Like people who normally like what I write got pissed at me for it. But like it was accurate, and Jeb Bush like deserved the good faith because he would be the first to go out and say, whoa, whoa, I would never dismiss the massacre of a child at a school as just stuff happens. That wasn't my intent. And he would genuinely feel bad about it, I think. Whereas like Donald Trump is like happy to know that there's an ambiguity here and that he is simultaneously promising violence and cloaking himself in deniability so that they can go troll the press when somebody, when like liberals pounce on him. And so like, it matters that he is a pro-violence and like empathy-free crook in all this, right? Like if Jeb Bush had dropped out of the 2016 race because he decided he wanted to, start a business, and he was like, I'm leaving politics because, you know, I went and met somebody and they made me an offer I couldn't refuse. You'd be like, oh, Jeb Bush is just selling out for money. Somebody made him a nice offer, right? Mm-hmm. But if Donald Trump was trying to pull something. And he said, like, I'm going to make him an offer they can't refuse. You would know he was speaking in the argot of mobsters, and he was talking about murder, right? Because that's who he is. Like, and so, yes, he said it. There was a pounce, and then there was this question, are we being unfair to Donald Trump? And the fact that it's Donald Trump, I think, just answers the question. It doesn't really matter that you have people like Kevin Drum trying to offer, I think, wrongly, if you just look at the plain text of what he said, like an overly generous assessment of it, because it's like, it's Donald Trump saying it, and he is well known to be a supporter of political violence. So of course, like, the subtext of his comments is like fair to pin on him. And that's why I think that, and so then, you know, in this sort of Streisand effect way, you get, now you have like people on cable news talking about like, was this unfair? And that means that, okay, well, let's look at the whole event. It's like, it starts with them calling the January 6th rioters hostages, and they sing a new MAGA version of the national anthem in order to celebrate the martyrs of January 6th. And then Trump promises a bloodbath. And it's like, it doesn't really matter if at the end of the day, you're only being like 85% fair to Trump, because like Trump loses any news cycle where people are reminded that he's the election liar who launched the insurrection.
So here's the other thing I don't love about this, right? So I was looking like, what's the actual coverage been, right? So Maggie Astor had a piece in the Times. The headline is Trump defends his warning of a quote bloodbath for the country. Subhead: he said he'd been referring only to the auto industry. But the piece makes exactly your point. You know, it says he said the bloodbath thing. It says that Trump said that was just about the auto industry. And then it goes to like, he called migrants animals, not people. He talked about hostages. And then she spins out to like lots of different things in which political violence hazes around Trump. Then second piece by Lisa Friedman, who's I think an environment reporter, says Trump's violent language toward EVs. The former president has deployed increasingly aggressive talk about electric vehicles and their effect on the American economy. So she notes that he said that EVs are going to kill America's auto industry, that he called them an assassination of jobs. He accused Biden of ordering a hit job on Michigan manufacturing. So that like he actually does this particular rhetorical trope specifically around electric cars a lot, is what she writes about. She quotes some experts on this. It's quite negative in its inflection because she's a climate beat reporter, you know, so she likes electric cars. One thing about both of these pieces is they seem to me that they make liberals seem weak and frightened.
Okay, here's where we're going to agree.
That if you are somebody who, because just keeping in mind what the campaign is, right? The campaign is that Joe Biden has a negative approval rating, that Donald Trump also has a negative approval rating. So we are currently contesting for the votes of people who don't like either candidate very much, right? One way you can contest for them is for like Joe Biden to try to do things that make people feel more positive about Biden, right? And that happens. There's like one track on which that's happening. But then there's attacking Trump to try to get double disapprovers to vote for Biden instead. To me, if you try to get yourself in the headspace of someone who thinks Joe Biden is a bad president, that critiques of Trump that kind of amount to like, ooh, we're so scared of Trump. He's so mean. He's so cruel. Yeah. He's going to punish us. I'm sure there's somebody out there who is like, that's unconscionable. I can't vote for Trump. But I think there's a lot of people who are like, yeah, I think Joe Biden and these libs are bad. And whatever I may think about Trump, I kind of like the fact that he's going to like own the libs and like murder these EV pushing losers. And to be like, it's true, we are losers. Like, I don't, you know, it carries this implication that like, we may be doing a terrible job of governing the country, but you like owe it to, but like you owe it to us to like, to save us from the mean bully. And it's a little bit pathetic versus a version of this where you're like, Trump is a threat to you, right? Like the audience of our criticism, right? That like Trump is promising to kill you, not Trump's promising to kill me, so you have to vote for me.
Can I break in to agree with you?
Yeah, yeah.
The I kind of feel like not that you stole my point, but like this is like a nuance about anti-Trump politics that like it's hard to break through with it because first order, I just want liberals and Democrats to be more willing to throw punches and like pounce, as we have like described it here, on whatever, and like actually just not be super discerning about it, just like be on the attack. But because so many of the things that like Trump, that makes Trump ripe to attack, are about him being a menace and a threat and a supporter of violence, is be careful when you do this not to do it from a position that makes you appear like weak, fearful, like you're in a panic, and that like he's going to hurt us if he wins, so we can't let him win. But I don't think that that means that you need to say anything necessarily about Social Security. Like Trump is promising a bloodbath if he wins. Well, like there's not going to be a bloodbath because we're going to stop him. Is like a version of it that is like we have agency here and we are not scared. He's dangerous, but we are bigger than him and we are stronger than him and we're going to defeat him. And, you know, you can't ask every resistance liberal to stop clutching their pearls about Donald Trump, but I think you can like get the, you know, the messaging people in the Democratic Party to be mindful of the fact that part of Trump's appeal, and I don't think it's like people who necessarily want to own the libs. It's just like Bill Clinton had a line about how people will take strong and wrong over sure. weak and right, something like that. Like Donald Trump draws a lot of political propulsive force simply from always acting like he is going to stick it to someone and he's not scared of them. And there's no reason that liberals can't embrace a similar affect when talking about him. There just isn't. But it's not like I think people genuinely are like alarmed. And so they want to lead with the thing that makes them scared. And I think that that pulls the party into this kind of like what, you know, how you described it, like you owe it to us to stop this guy who's going to hurt us if he wins. And that's just a really like weak and unappealing.
I just also want to say that like, I do think there's like a slightly more systemic, you know, origin to this, which is like if you think about the fundraising emails that we get from congressional Democrats, I mean, especially the ones that like that Mothership Strategies got really good at writing, they are all based on these like you know, going back to before Trump, they're these like panic subject lines, right? Like we're losing, like terrible news for you, you know, like sky is falling kind of stuff. And that's based on like A/B testing of what gets people
yes.
to open fundraising emails. Those people don't think of themselves as doing like persuasion messaging. They're doing fundraising emails. But part of, you know, the nature of internet culture, right, is that like all forms of communication are just sort of communication.
Yeah.
A lot of what Democrats do, not only in their fundraising emails, but like in their tweets, in other things like that, are designed as list building exercises rather than as outward facing persuasion messages. And I think that that kind of, we also just know liberals as people are more anxious than conservatives, you know? And
that's because Jews are all liberals.
Yes. It's because Jews are all Jews and women.
So fucked now.
Well, women are more anxious than men. And liberals are more anxious than conservatives. And those
and
two
Jews
things,
are more anxious
those
than
two
Goyen.
Things may relate. We are both Jews, just for the record. All that being said, so if you are trying to mobilize highly engaged liberals, playing on anxiety is like a good strategy. But I think it's like a bad look, you know, to present to the world, right? Versus, you know, a worldview that has a little more swagger, right? And is a little bit more about how, like, we are going to protect you rather than, like, you need to protect us. Like, the you being the electorate, the swing voters, right? Like, we're going to save swing voters from the corruption and incompetence of Donald Trump versus, like, we need you, the swing voters, to reluctantly save us from Trump's powerful lib-owning. And it's just, I think, like, something for everybody to think about, you know, to just recognize that, like, there is a difference in, like, the psychometric composition of the party bases, and that whenever you're like leaning into anxiety as an emotional cue, you're like speaking to your niece and not to like swing voters.
Well, you're acting like a character in a Woody Allen movie that like, how do you feel about that character when you're actually watching the movie? Do you think that that's like an object of respect? Like somebody that you would follow into a fight or like...
Does it convey that that person would do a good job of dealing with an unforeseen international crisis?
Right.
Right?
Like, I mean, it's dumb. It is dumb that like politics turns on these emotional signaling mechanisms, but it's just true. And like, we have to deal with it as, I don't know, as liberal elites who like really do think that it's important to beat Donald Trump. And in part because he is scary. Like, right. Okay, well, how do you suppress that or deal with the threat in, you know, in the same way that like there's this movie called Force Majeure. Mm-hmm. And there was like a remake of it with Will Ferrell, and it has a different name, but it's like basically he's with his family at a ski resort, and there's an avalanche, and it's a controlled avalanche, I think, but he freaks out and they're at the chalet and he like grabs his cell phone and runs inside and leaves his family to be crushed by the falling snow. And of course opens this huge rift in his family. And like, of course it does, because how can you respect somebody who wouldn't try to save you in a situation like that? And it's like, it doesn't mean you shouldn't be scared, right? Like if somebody tried to hurt somebody in my family and they were bigger than me and I thought trying to defend them might imperil me, I would be scared, but I would still try to find it within myself to do that. And however that worked out in the long run, like I would be able to sleep well at night having behaved that way. And I think that they would like see something in me that they admired and cherished for the rest of their life, that when it was dangerous to him, he tried to help. And like, that's just, I think, how humans are, how humans see other humans. And like, just try to resemble that and you'll be better at politics.
So should we take a break and talk about, yes, talk because, about double because, meanings in general?
Yes, but let's take a break. And then I'm going to turn this around on you because I think this insight that we're agreeing on actually cuts against some of your other politics. But if you want to hear that, and you're not already a paid subscriber, go to politics.fm and upgrade your subscription.